happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
He washed my sins away. Happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi everyone, I'm Gary Null. Today we are going to do a lot of looking at vaccines for children, for adults. If you're in the field of looking at the science and the politics and the profiteering, you see where this is going. They're trying to mandate childhood vaccines, and then from there, they want to mandate adult vaccines. So we're pushing back on it, trying to use the best that science has to share and common sense. Also, there's a big rollout with 5G, and these are small cell towers. And they're so small that they have to be about 500 feet apart, which means you have to have thousands upon thousands per city in order to have that connection. That means virtually every single person living in a city that has 5G is being irradiated, is being pulsed, and with these electromagnetic waves. We're very concerned. I've studied the science, and it is apparent that this is an extremely dangerous measure. I would put this right up there with asbestos as a serious health concern, except this is impacting all of us, and yet they're putting a pretty face on it. Oh, you can get your calls and computer faster. So we're going to be having, over the next 2 weeks, an expert almost per day on challenging it. Please share this information as often as you can and try to bring this information to your local council and challenge your city councils. And hopefully we can make some progress in slowing it down. They have not done the health studies. Today, Dr. Sharon Goldberg testifies at Michigan's 5G small cell tower legislative hearing. We'll give you that opportunity to hear her. I have several commentaries that I'll be sharing, and one today on, I'm going to talk back to the World Health Organization that equates those who challenge vaccine safety or efficacy as one of the worst problems of our health in the world. They actually put those who challenged vaccines up there with global warming, the Ebola virus, and dengue fever. That's insane. And yet the media has not challenged it. Being the lapdogs they are, they pick it right up and run with it. So we will have something to say about that. We're going to begin with the latest on health and healing. This comes from Florida International University about how to breathe for better health, studying and test taking. So if you're reading something about this whole subject, obviously you're breathing. But are you doing it right? From the moment we're born, we just do it. We take breathing for granted until someone or something takes our breath away. Most of us don't realize that as we grow up, we change the way we breathe. Babies use diaphragmatic breathing. Somewhere along the way, we develop bad habits that develop into thoracic breathing, and that's according to the specialist at the Medical Student Counseling and Wellness Center at Herbert Wortham College of Medicine. Now, what's this mean? It means diaphragmatic breathing, also called deep or belly breathing, is done by contracting the diaphragm, a large dome-shaped muscle at the base of the lungs, and it is more efficient than just regular throat breathing, and also called shallower chest breathing, which uses the muscles in your upper chest. So when you breathe with your upper chest or upper lungs or upper body, what happens is you are taking in less oxygen, which is vital to your body and organs. So breathing is essentially a gas exchange. You inhale oxygen, you exhale carbon dioxide. That's a byproduct of the food we eat, which the body needs to get rid of. And so it does reach toxic levels and shouldn't, because then it's dangerous. The misconception is the longer you suck in air, the better. But it's the longer that you exhale that provides the most benefit. In biofeedback sessions offered at the Wellness Center, medical students are often amazed to see the actual physiological changes increasing blood flow to the brain and vital organs that occurred during their calm breathing exercises. So it's not just that you feel better. You're actually looking at a screen and you see your body reacting to it. During one biofeedback session, one of the people noticed that calm breathing, or what I would call mindful breathing, increased the temperature in your hands. And now that's using the technique to stay warm while studying for hours in the library, which one student said gets chilly. I found for myself that, and I'll show you how this works, that I was going out for a race. It was a short 4-mile race. And the gun went off, and I went out with the lead group, right behind the lead group. And the first mile was around a 4:27 pace. And from there, you generally bring it down. You get faster each mile. But I found that I was getting slower each mile. And by the last mile, coming up the east side of what's called Cat Hill, very steep 1-mile incline, I went almost 9 minutes a mile. I didn't even train that slow. I trained at 6 minutes. So something was wrong. And then I thought about it. What was different? Well, I was a little anxious. Okay. So was my anxiousness in doing this race, was that impacting how I was breathing? And I thought about that, and I said, I'm going to try an experiment. I'm going to do mindful meditation all week, and I'm going to do that when I train. Just be very relaxed and let my body flow, no forcing it. And then that worked. And so when the next race came, we had races every single week in Central Park for decades. I did another race, a little longer, 10K, and I was actually faster because I was breathing deeply. So it was that deep diaphragmatic breathing and a strong exhale, a little extra push of the air coming out. Slow inhale, stronger exhale, relaxing your body, letting your body be more fluid. And it made all the difference in the world. I was then able to share that experience, that insight, with all the members over the years of the Natural Living and Walking Club. Don't go out tense. Relax into doing something. In fact, an upcoming retreat, we have probably the person who did more to teach us about breathing properly than any other person in American history, and that's Shyam Bhatnagar. He was in India. He is the one who brought sound and healing to the United States. In fact, if you hear the word chakra, he's the one who brought chakra to the United States over almost 50 years ago. In any case, I believe he's around 84. And he called and he said he'd love to come and teach a class in breathing. I said, great. You know, so he came and visited with me for about a week, and he is in great shape, great health, and so he'll be there teaching. But one of the things that he teaches is breathing and sound and how to breathe. You think it's easy, you think it's self-evident, it isn't, but it can make enormous difference in our capacity for concentration, our energy. In fact, in a lot of races, I go out dead last. I mean, absolutely the last person. In fact, there was one race where there were 134 athletes in it. I was dead last, came in first. How's that possible? Because breathing is half of all athletic performance. How you breathe. Up tight in the neck, your muscles constrict, you're not getting oxygen in, and you're not getting the oxygen in the red blood cells, and you end up with oxygen debt. meaning the cell doesn't have enough oxygen in order to create adenosine triphosphate or ATP, so you don't have the combustion, the mitochondria don't have the energy. But if you relax and you keep breathing even, then the further you go, the faster you get. It does make a difference. I can verify that. So change your breathing and change your life. Calm breathing, as the name implies, helps to calm and relax. How many times you see someone who's upset and they might be crying or really angry, and you just, what is the first thing you say? You say, calm down. Just take a breath. How many times have you heard that word? Take a breath. Now just relax. Take another breath, deep breath. Let it out, deep breath, let it out. So it's something that people have always known. It's just the science has caught up with innate wisdom. And studies show that it can reduce tension and anxiety and improve concentration and memory, all of which are particularly helpful to students as a study aid and a test taking. In contrast, shallow breathing can add anxiety, muscle tension, fatigue, can result in panic attacks and headaches. From Foro Italian University in Rome comes a study on the more quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, that you take in. Onions, that's a good quercetin. Apples, that's a good quercetin. It can protect erythrocytes from oxidative damage after exercise. So research at the university found evidence that regularly taking quercetin, which is the natural flavonoid, and fruits and vegetables can prevent damage to your red blood cells, those erythrocytes, caused by oxidants. This finding was published in Nutrition Research following clinical study. So if you took quercetin capsules, I'm suggesting at about 500 to 1,000 milligrams a day, it can do a lot of good, especially if you have a tendency to bruise. It can about prevent bruising. If you have spider veins, if you have swelling in the feet, if you have some wrinkles in the face, if you have jowliness or dropping weight of your face as it ages, quercetin is the nutrient along with vitamin C that helps rebuild collagen, and that tightens your skin back up naturally. From the University of Queensland in Australia, zinc could help as non-antibiotic treatment for intrauterine infections. And that's important because millions of people worldwide suffer from bacterial infections, including urinary tract infections. They're one of the most common bacterial infections worldwide, at least 150 million cases a year. And generally, it's you're looking at E. coli as a major cause of it, and just proper hygiene, washing and not just wiping, will help probably eliminate half of those. Because bacteria move, and if it's moist and there's moisture, if you're sitting, they move, and they can move into the urinary tract. So keep yourself hygienic. But also, this was published in the Proceedings National Academy of Sciences, zinc is great for the immune system, and it helps with this particular condition. So zinc is, in effect, a non-antibiotic treatment. Doesn't take much. And finally, from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, published in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, vitamin D can protect against pollution-associated asthma, and especially if you have children, and especially if those children are overweight. So that's important to get vitamin D in. Oh, and by the way, from Iran at University of Medical Sciences, we are all familiar with Helicobacter. Helico, H-E-L-I-C-O, Bacter, B-A-C-T-E-R, pylori, P-A-Y-L-O-R-I-E. Now, H. pylori, is what it's called, represents an infection that's very common. More than half of the world's population likely is walking around with these bacteria in your gut. Nonetheless, they're responsible for the majority of ulcers of the small intestine and stomach, and difficult to treat. And then you start giving them antibiotics, and then they can change, they morph. Now you have a superbug that's really hard to treat. So what's the latest way of treating them? Now, I've always found raw cabbage juice 3 times a day at a 12-ounce glass can do it. But they are saying honey with black cumin was found to treat it, and very successfully. So what I would do is this. I would take 1 teaspoon of Manuka honey. I would stir it around with 1 teaspoon, one teaspoon of black cumin seed oil, and dilute that into 12 ounces of cabbage juice. That would be the best way in the world to get rid of stomach ulcers and itis is in the intestine. And coming up, I'll talk about how University of Southern California found that green tea and rice compounds can reverse Alzheimer's-like symptoms. That'll be on an upcoming show. That was published in the Journal of Biological Chemistry, but I'll talk more about that soon. We're going to take a break and come back, and then I'm going to share an updated commentary with you, an original investigative report. This original report will be published within the next half hour on PRN.fm. This will be the 53rd article in our series, Understanding the Science or Lack Thereof of Vaccines. And this is particularly a strong one because this is this is one of the worst forms of McCarthyism in medicine I've ever seen. Richard Gale and I have worked on this. It is fully footnoted, so please download it and share it with everyone you can. Why? All across the media, that means newspapers and television, radio broadcasts, and leading journals and magazines, a unified voice has declared that vaccines do not cause autism and debilitating neurological disorders, and unvaccinated individuals, especially parents, are to blame for recent infections and their outbreak. There is no discourse, no debate on the truth of these proclamations. There is only dogmatic certainty in an accusation. This does not surprise us. Orwell wrote, intellectual honesty is a crime in any totalitarian country. And for decades, our health agencies, like the FDA and the CDC, have been compromised by private interest and bereft of any integrity whatsoever. The plan to end individual freedom regarding medical choice has been in the works for a long time, with the ultimate goal of driving the last nail into the coffin of those who question the government's word. It is also an attempt to silence the 7 million parents with vaccine-damaged children. The World Health Organization lists people who question universal vaccination among the 10 greatest threats to the planet, along with climate change, HIV, dengue, and Ebola. The message is resoundingly clear. Shut up and get your damn vaccine. It will only be a matter of time before the Federal Health Agency's self-appointed domination over all human rights expands to mandating psychiatric drugs for make-believe disorders, like if you challenge government, if you challenge industry, then authority defiance disorder, to which you will be forced into psychiatric care. Anyone who challenges anything in our healthcare system will be perceived as a problem, a domestic problem, and therefore outlawing non-conventional medical practice. It is entirely possible that in the near future there will be no chiropractors, osteopaths, clinical nutritionists, or dietitians, holistic nurses, or dentists. If you think that is not possible, it is, and it's happening as we speak. It is not outside the realm of possibility to foresee the rest of parents who delay or avoid vaccinating their children. If you think these things are just not going to happen, you don't know how many parents have had their children taken away from them because they refuse vaccination or some other medical procedure, such as chemotherapy. Even if the child had no cancer in their body and had been successfully treated, let's say, with surgery, and the parents want to use some more non-toxic alternative to develop the child's immune system to prevent further cancer relapse, social services are brought in, and this mindless social services does not think, it simply acts. So we have to be realistic. The World Health Organization, of course, is a notoriously scandal-plagued criminal organization, spending more on travel expenses for its executives than it does on public health. A 2017 Associated Press expose found the organization spent over $200 million per year on travel expenses, more than it spends to fight malaria, $61 million, tuberculosis, $59 million, and AIDS and hepatitis, $71 million combined. Senior executives get first-class airfare and luxurious five-star accommodations funded by taxpayers on its 194 member countries, of which U.S. contributes the most. Other health organizations ban their members from flying first or even business class, reasoning that their budgets are better spent on actually treating disease. The World Health Organization regularly bars media from its ostensibly transparent meetings. Journalists were hauled bodily out of the last two biennial meetings by the World Health Organization's Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which sets tobacco policy for about 90% of the population of the world, leaving bruises on one American journalist who merely wanted to cover the theoretically public proceedings. After being manhandled out of the convention by half a dozen burly security guards, journalist Drew Johnson spoke to a delegate who admitted, quote, "We don't want people to know what we're doing." Let me repeat that. This is the same World Health Organization that the New York Times, the Washington Post that pretends to actually be a legitimate publication, CNN, who have not done their homework. Quote, the World Health Organization delegate, "We don't want people to know what we are doing," end quote. The World Health Organization also maintains a blacklist of journalists who are critical of its policies. A journalist who had harsh words for the agency's bungling of the 2014 West African Ebola epidemic was frozen out of contacts she had interviewed in the past and dropped from the World Health Organization's Ebola email update list. An independent panel of health experts concluded that the World Health Organization's slow response to that epidemic, waiting more than 3 months to respond and using resources poorly when it did, contributed to an explosive increase in deaths and suffering. Meanwhile, an internal audit conducted in May 2016 found fraud, corruption, and sexual harassment were rampant throughout the World Health Organization. This is not an organization from which Americans should be taking their moral direction. When you engage in fraud, when you engage in corruption, when you engage in sexual harassment, you should not be in any way, shape, or form virtue signaling that somehow your word is the word from on high and allow all these supplicant reporters for the New York Times in particular not to criticize the source of the material to which they then pass it on as if it is virtue-laden. But it's part and parcel of a secretive top-down structure of pharmaceutical totalitarianism that holds itself outside accountability while caring only for its bottom line. It is clear that a program is underway, orchestrated at the highest echelons of government in collaboration with the private pharmaceutical industry to institutionalize nationwide vaccination mandates for all infants, children, and now all adults. Representative Adam Schiff has led the congressional effort of private companies such as Amazon, Facebook, Google, and Pinterest, and others to unilaterally censor personal and organizational websites, public advocacy health sites, publications, and books that question the gospel of vaccine safety. Having written over 52 articles, this being the 53rd, on vaccines over the past dozen years, we are finding it far more difficult to research content that questions the vaccine paradigm. Bills are appearing rapidly across state legislatures that will make personal, religious, and philosophical exemptions impossible. Only those who can prove sound medical reasons not to be vaccinated would be exempted. This is especially worrisome because vaccinology has been unable to prove categorically that vaccines are safe and effective in every case. Consequently, health officials want to impose on the nation a dangerous and scientifically unfounded one-size-fits-all vaccine schedule, contrary to volumes of evidence that vaccine safety is nothing more than wishful thinking. The fact of the matter is that vaccinology is not a closed science. There remains much that immunologists do not understand about the body's biomolecular and genetic responses to vaccines' viral components and their growing number of toxic ingredients. The height of medical hubris is when health agencies declare that vaccine safety is a closed matter and there's no reason to dig any deeper. Last year, the media pumped out headlines about the nation's rising autism rates, accompanied by the sub-message that experts do not know exactly why this crisis is taking place. The truth is that our health officials have shown they are seriously disinterested in discovering autism's causal factors. They are deeply worried about what they will uncover. Or perhaps it is more likely, based upon numerous international documents and congressional hearings, that the health agencies are completely certain about the causes, but must cover it up to avoid a public outcry and retaliation. Somewhere along the course of the vicious debates between staunch vaccine advocates and those who pose serious scientific questions about vaccine safety, vaccines and pharmaceutical drugs entered separate worlds of their own. Few people question conventional pharmaceutical drugs and their serious adverse effects, including lifelong disabilities and death by taking these drugs. Most people today have witnessed the debilitating effects that prescription medications have had on their loved ones, whether an aging parent, a child, or even themselves, during their own medical treatment for a serious health condition. In 2016, over 63,600 people died from prescription drug poisoning, including legal opiates. Moreover, physicians are more willing to caution patients about drugs' adverse effects and will often instruct patients how to detect adverse effects that might be caused by their medications. But the administration of vaccines occupies a different universe. The average American does not regard vaccines as drugs. Consequently, the doctor-patient discourse about vaccine safety is distinct and shamefully, if not criminally, misinformed. Vaccines are drugs. I repeat, vaccines are dangerous drugs. Although they are biologic, meaning they are based upon viral or bacterial organisms as primary causative and active components, they contain many other registered and monitored substances. And like every drug, every vaccine has its warnings and observed adverse effects. And before the Department of Health and Human Services recently discontinued drug classifications for prescription drugs to pregnant women, almost every vaccine was classified as a Category C drug. This means there is no vaccine that's been studied in pregnant women to determine whether it is safe for the fetus, and animal studies have shown that vaccines cause problems in the offspring. In fact, the TDP and influenza vaccines were licensed without any supporting studies conducted to determine whether these vaccines' inflammatory and biological responses might affect childbirth. And today, the CDC recommends both these vaccines be given to pregnant women. Let's stop and think about that. Are we not a nation that should be supporting equal rights for women? That means equal protection, equal concern, equal justification through good quality independent science that nothing that goes into a woman's body should allow that body or the developing body inside the body, a fetus, to be adversely affected. And yet the scientific studies show exactly that is happening when it comes to vaccines and animal studies. So why did the CDC and the FDA also decide that there will be no studies on what happens to a cancer-causing agent inside of a pregnant woman? That is using women's bodies. That is abusing women's bodies. That is medical misogyny. And yet, no discourse, no Me Too movements for it. And think of the abuse when a child is born with a defective immune system, a neurological system, respiratory system, neurological system that may take months, even years, to determine its full impact. And no one apologizes because it's just the cost of doing business. When we're told how, before the advent of the modern vaccine era, mortality rates for infectious diseases were much higher than today, and that the decline in such deaths is due to the vaccine miracle, we're being fed lies and myths. Certainly before the advances in hygiene, improved working and living conditions, the sterilization of milk, or at least the pasteurization, which killed the bacteria, and chlorine for our water supplies, at least cleaning up our water supplies, and the discovery of antibiotics, which were a miracle, and sterilization, and better food for children and adults. And children were unprotected from the scourges of smallpox and scarlet fever and polio and measles and rubella and pertussis. Many times they engaged in long hours of work. And the 19th century pandemics ravaged populations. That is true. But vaccines did little to reduce infectious disease death rates. Scarlet fever, which at one time was killing more people than smallpox, largely disappeared because of public health measures to increase sanitation and nutrition and access to clean water. And government mortality records for the past 150 years, which we have studied in depth. In fact, at least 10 other physicians or PhDs along with us have studied all of the charts going back 150 years in the U.S. and the United Kingdom shows the most dangerous infectious diseases were already approaching a zero death rate before the first vaccine was unleashed on the public. When the measles vaccine was first launched in 1962, the death rate from measles infection was 1 in 500,000. But the official narrative glosses over these facts. Instead, today's vaccine cartel employs complicated mathematical formulas and tosses out misleading numbers with no relevance to historical reality in order to persuade us that vaccines have saved hundreds of millions of lives. That is a lie. They have not. We must acknowledge that all vaccines are unavoidably unsafe. Who says? The unanimous decision of the 2011 Supreme Court, quote, all vaccines are unavoidably unsafe. That's the Supreme Court in Ruswitz versus Wyeth case. Therefore, all vaccines on the market are categorically unsafe. Perhaps in some distant future, a vaccine will be developed to effectively and safely immunize against an infectious disease without any adverse effects or other pitfalls. So far, such a vaccine does not exist and never has. Therefore, conscientious efforts to adhere to the precautionary principle that was adopted by the United Nations in 1992 and vigilant and consistent evolution and reevaluation of the risks and benefit of vaccination is both essential and a human right to the U.S. government if they encourage and protect and uphold it, but they do not. In fact, the government and all of its agencies are complicit with the media and the pharmaceutical industry in promoting the talking points that sell the product. If we accept the Supreme Court decision that vaccines are, quote, unavoidably unsafe, then the question becomes, how unsafe are they? We possess an enormous body of yet-to-be-challenged research and clinical trials and case examples of severe vaccine injury and court compensations paid out to families with vaccine-injured children, enough to conclude in a reasonable way that vaccine development has a long way to go before a medically proven safe vaccine is available. Unfortunately, it is our opinion that this research is being completely ignored and irresponsibly refuted by the CDC and its rabid supporters. They are the proponents of mass vaccination. But what else does it tell us when we are told that we are a country of freedoms and that we are proud of those freedoms, and we're unique among all nations of the world in the rights of our freedoms? But what about the freedom of choice? Do we not have the right to make the right or wrong decisions? Now, there is a consequence to us and those that care about us and society as a whole when we make consistently wrong choices. If you consistently eat the wrong foods knowingly, eating them, and you become obese, you have heart disease, and then you have to be treated, and you cannot afford it in the state and the federal governments through Medicare and Medicaid, Medicare, or through private insurance or public insurance, helps you. That is a burden we're all paying for your intentional neglect and intentional lack of awareness. But should you not have the right? You may not like what I say, but do not have the right, and is it not codified by the First Amendment to say what I feel? And should I not also respect your right, even though I may disagree with what you say, to have your right? Since when do we say that you cannot say something that we find offensive? And now everything seems to be offensive to someone. Just imagine this. Today, George Carlin, Lenny Bruce, Mort Saul, Jonathan Winters. Yeah. A lot of these people would not be invited to any venue to share their comedy. Richard Pryor, absolutely not. Because someone would find some word caused a trigger reaction. That's how down the rabbit hole we've gone. That's a danger. So would you say, we only allow you to give comedy if we agree to what is funny? We only allow you to talk about politics if we agree, ideological, with what you're saying, or on any other topic? So who gives the government the right to mandate that they can supersede our personal sovereignty by putting something into our body that we don't want there? And if we're educated about it and we choose based upon our education of the topic that we do not want that violation, we do not want a government-mandated poison going into our body, and if there is no hue and cry against it, the media is supportive of the government, the nanny state, how dangerous is that ideology? During the early 1980s, why did the pharmaceutical companies, at least those that remained in the vaccine business, go to Washington and lobby, heavy dollars spent, and demand the government assistance in order to continue manufacturing vaccines? Before President Reagan signed the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act in 1986, only a handful of companies continued to manufacture and sell vaccines. Many pharmaceutical companies got out of the business altogether because the high rates of vaccine-related medical complications and deaths. Vaccine makers were so burdened with lawsuits that they lost, that it was no longer a profitable product to pursue. The whole-cell pertussis vaccine, which was included in the early DPT shot, was a particularly horrendous vaccine associated with serious neurological consequences. Even today, most vaccine proponents acknowledge this. A 2003 paper submitted to the Committee on the Evaluation of Vaccine Purchase Financing noted that scientists were voicing their concerns about this vaccine back in the 1930s and 40s. By the 1970s, other nations, notably Japan, Germany, and the United Kingdom, either discontinued offering the vaccine or eased off its administration. No such efforts were made in the United States, and vaccine injuries continued to increase, along with scores of lawsuits by parents of severely damaged children. By the time Reagan signed the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, only one company, literally, continued to manufacture the DPT vaccine. Faced with such steep financial risk, pharmaceutical companies threatened to exit the vaccine market unless their products received government protection from lawsuits. The government capitulated, and Reagan signed a bill that relieved the pharmaceutical industry of any liability for injury or death due to vaccination. The subsequent no-fault compensation program opened the floodgates for old and new drug and biotech companies to enter the market, and new vaccines have been on the rise ever since. It's a multi-billion-dollar-a-year profit center for vaccines. The NCVI Act, the National Vaccine Act, enabled the vaccine industry to take control of the CDC. It inaugurated a gold rush, allowing new and largely experimental vaccines laden with highly toxic mercury, preservatives, and aluminum adjuvants to pour into the market. The National Vaccine Information Center's co-founder, Barbara Lowe Fisher, has called the federal program, quote, a drug company stockholder's dream and a parent's worst nightmare. In addition, there was no incentive to be ethically responsible and cautious about vaccine safety. If you couldn't be sued, And if you get to keep all the prophets, no matter how many people were injured or died, and if nobody can be held accountable personally, then just pump every vaccine you could out into the market and then make sure that you control the legislatures and the federal agencies to mandate them. So get your scientists from your company on an advisory board at the CDC and the FDA to make sure your vaccine was one of those mandated, because every one of those mandated vaccines represented billions of dollars a year in extra profit with no downside liability. And so that's the reality of the FDA loopholes and drug and vaccine licensing procedures, basically streamlining vaccines' path to the market. Reagan's bill thus paved the way for a national catastrophe. When the act was signed, autism rates were 1 in 2,500. During the following 10-year period, the rate tripled to continue to rise, and today it's 1 in 36, and 1 in 28 boys who are vaccinated will get autism. An even darker side to the story unfolded when the CDC discovered vaccines were definitively among the causal agents behind the autism epidemic and covered up that fact. The secret Simpsonwood meeting held at the secluded retreat center near the CDC headquarters in Atlanta has been thoroughly exposed by vaccination watched organizations and public health advocates. Now, during a recent interview, in fact, just yesterday with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the attorney responsible for uncovering the Simpsonwood gathering and acquiring the meeting's transcripts, further details from his ongoing investigations for Freedom of Information Act submissions were provided. This is a story you need to know. In the late 1990s, the CDC's Dr. Tom Vera-Stratton conducted research to determine whether or not vaccines were contributing to the rising autism epidemic. One of the mostly obvious candidates was the hepatitis B vaccine, routinely injected into infants immediately after birth. And the vaccine ingredients that were most dangerous, of course, were ethyl mercury or thimerosal, which was used as a preservative in most vaccines at that time. So relying upon databases of vaccine records of over 144,000 children, Vera-Stratton and his co-researcher compared autism rates among vaccinated versus unvaccinated kids. They discovered an 11.9% increase risk for the hepatitis B vaccine alone. Robert F. Kennedy remarked that there is only a 10% risk of getting cancer from smoking a pack of cigarettes a day for 20 years. Therefore, the hepatitis B vaccine given to your baby, which at the time contained thimerosal, was more toxic than cigarette smoking. After subjecting the data to a series of statistical manipulations to reduce the study's alarming positive results, the CDC scientists were still unable to bring the risk below 2.5%. Seized with panic, they convened a secret cabal, an emergency meeting, bringing together the executives of high-ranking corporations, scientists from the U.S. and British health agencies, and once again, there is that corrupt World Health Organization, as well as the private vaccine manufacturers. During the discussion of nearly 70 people weighing whether to go public with the CDC's findings, which showed that vaccines were certainly contributing to the rising autism rates, participants resolved to conceal the results from the public. The entire vaccine industry would have been jeopardized if the truth were revealed to the American people. It was therefore crucial that new studies were performed that would conclude vaccines were perfectly safe and there was no need to worry about vaccines causing autism. Meanwhile, the CDC would fudge the research methodology, data, and interpretation of results to show no correlation. According to Kennedy, CDC executives determined that the U.S. was not the ideal country to conduct further thimerosal research to negate a vaccine-autism link. It was critical to get their research peer-reviewed and published in the most prestigious medical journals. Therefore, Denmark was selected as the location for the studies. And unlike the approval process for vaccines on the United States childhood vaccine schedule, the Danes were administering fewer vaccines with less or no mercury, hence less mercury bioburden. The CDC recruited and funded a shady medical operative to oversee the Danish research and assure that the results would please his masters in the U.S. government. Dr. Paul Thorsen, who served as the CDC's chief coordinator for the Danish study, took advantage of flaws in Denmark's National Registry for Infectious Diseases in Autism Patients. His subsequent studies, comprised of large manufactured data, were eventually published in leading peer-reviewed medical journals and made the claim that thimerosal did not contribute to autism and other neurological disorders. Today, it is common knowledge among vaccine opponents that Dr. Thorsen was later indicted on 22 counts of fraud and money laundering involving over $1 million earmarked for autism research under the CDC grants. He was subsequently listed on the FBI's most wanted list. However, the CDC blocked every effort to extradite Thorsen back to the United States to stand trial, and he was able to continue to live, as he does to this day, lavishly in Denmark with his female companion, a former CDC employee. And while Thorsen and his Danish colleagues at Aarhus University were conducting junk fraudulent science to exonerate thimerosal back in the United States, the CDC began to try to absolve the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine from any association with neurodegenerative conditions leading to autism. The MMR vaccine does not contain thimerosal, but relies upon a neurotoxic aluminum compound adjuvant to trigger an immunological response. Earlier, Dr. Andrew Wakefield at the British Royal Hospital had uncovered a link between the MMR vaccine's measles virus and the onset of gastrointestinal inflammation commonly found in autistic children. To this day, the mantra repeated by the CDC and all of the media has been that Wakefield's, quote, discredited research has contributed to low MMR compliance rates. All lies. Vaccine advocates unceasingly target Wakefield as public enemy number one for fueling the anti-vaccine movement and the rise in families delayed or avoiding vaccinating their children. But this is a flagrant lie. The CDC's own statistics reveal that Wakefield's study, published in The Lancet, barely made a dent in American MMR vaccine compliance. We have a chart. It's an official chart, and it shows the average MMR compliance rate before Wakefield's paper was 89.6%. Compliance dropped to 86% when the public saw the paper, but then by 1998 had risen to 92%. The following year. So compliance has remained relatively stable above 92% ever since. In fact, Wakefield's paper did absolutely nothing to deter compliance. And I might mention that Wakefield's partner on that, one of the most respected gastroenterologists in the world, was cleared of all charges. The High Court, the equivalent of their Supreme Court in Great Britain, threw it out. So Wakefield has been exonerated. Where have you seen a single member of the American media apologize, including especially Anderson Cooper, who went on a tirade against him, all without doing his homework? So Cooper owes Wakefield an apology. All he has to do is look at the highest court in Great Britain exonerating that team, and you'll see what they're missing at CNN. In any case, Dr. William Thompson, who later became a distinguished senior scientist at the CDC, participated in the CDC's MMR studies and assisted in obscuring evidence, covering it up, showing a direct correlation between the vaccine and childhood autism, an absolute unequivocal association. Upon turning whistleblower, and he only turned whistleblower when he found out that the person that he had been talking to about 100 times over the phone for the previous 2 years, had recorded it. And he only started to record it after Thompson admitted that they had destroyed evidence and covered it up clear to the top of the head of the CDC. Then the person who was recording it, his son was vaccine damaged and autistic. Dr. Brian picked up on this and now has all the recordings. I've listened to Thompson's voice acknowledging this. Thompson released confidential CDC documents, including copies of shredded originals, to Congressman William Posey and biology professor Brian Hooker, providing the CDC malfeasance. Now, these are criminal acts, that what the CDC did. And this treasure trove of criminal activity at the highest levels of the CDC, we discovered the CDC had known for over a decade that when the MMR vaccine was administered at 36 months, according to the CDC vaccine schedule, there was a 300% increase in childhood autistic regression among African-American boys. Nevertheless, through the CDC statistical and methodological trickery, the data was manipulated to hide that relationship. Dr. Thompson is not the only scientist and high federal official to come clean about the vaccine autism link. Over a decade ago, the late and former director of the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Bernadine Healy, told journalist Cheryl Atkinson that she completely denied any vaccine autism connection until she undertook a more thorough review of the scientific literature. Dr. Healy confirmed that there are groups of children who are highly susceptible to neurological damage from vaccines. And Dr. Healy confirmed that the CDC does not know all the risk factors that might predispose an individual to vaccine injury. And for that reason, she recommended more research to identify those groups that might have higher susceptibility to vaccine injury. No studies, she said, have been conducted to look at kids who come down with autism spectrum symptoms within a few weeks of receiving vaccine. In addition, a 2004 paper from the Institute of Medicine distributed an internal report with instructions, quote, listen carefully to this. This is from our government's own Institute of Medicine, quote, to not pursue susceptible groups. Do not look for those patients, those children who may be vulnerable, end quote. Wow. That is the government's highest body repository of scientific information engaging in a cover-up. So if you exclude any child from a vaccine study who is susceptible, then you've just excluded the ones most likely to end up showing that vaccine causes injury. And we have it. Again, this is from their own 2004 Institute of Medicine internal report that we have a copy of. Quote, quote, to not pursue susceptibility groups, do not look for those patients, those children who may be vulnerable. 12 years have passed and the CDC has made no attempt whatsoever to pursue this line of research. Quite simply, our entire federal health system refuses to conduct crucial research essential to the health and well-being of the nation, especially when it concerns vaccines, because it is petrified of the truth. What the vaccine industry arsenal of research sorely lacks is biological gold standard placebo-controlled clinical trials to support the CDC's unwavering position on vaccine safety. Accepted vaccine research is little more than junk science, and junk science can make for the best propaganda to convince a population into believing in vaccine safety. Joseph Goebbels understood this all too well when he stated, quote, a lie told often enough, people will believe it, and you will even come to believe it yourself. American children are now the most over-vaccinated in the world. Although the Protection Act mandated a vaccine injury review process to compensate families for vaccine injury, it has dismally failed in its responsibilities, preferring to protect the myth about vaccine safety. Thousands of families have been forced to financially fend for themselves in order to provide care for severely vaccine-damaged children. The problem is further aggravated by the vaccine schedule now requiring 71 vaccinations to be injected pre- and postnatally into children. The so-called vaccine court fails to admit the robust science confirming vaccine threats to healthy neurological development. As early as 2014, a report released by the Council on Foreign Relations to identify countries with the highest rates of disease outbreaks accidentally revealed that the most highly vaccinated populations are also those with the greatest number of outbreaks for those same infectious diseases. This was especially the case for measles, mumps, rubella, polio, and pertussis. The United States, Canada, the European Union, Australia, New Zealand, and Japan, each with the highest number of mandated vaccines, led the list. The Office of Medical and Scientific Justice, which analyzed the report, concluded that the Council on Foreign Relations report clearly suggests the theory, quote, herd immunity is failing or was flawed to begin with. Given the repeated incidences of infectious outbreaks in populations with 94% or more vaccine compliance and the emergence of new viral strains, the concept of herd immunity should be abandoned. The office offers several possibilities to explain the report. Vaccines are increasingly becoming ineffective and causing immune dysfunction, and vaccine antigen responses may be reprogramming viruses while weakening the immune system of the most susceptible individuals. I am halfway through our article. I will leave it to you to read the remaining part. It is going to be posted now on PRN.fm, and it is our way of talking back to the insanity, the irresponsibility of the World Health Organization, and to the major media that did not question the report saying that those who questioned, including 7 million adults whose children were vaccine damaged, and just put yourself for a moment in the position of being one of 7 million people with children who've died, or you have to take care of them the rest of your life and they're not covered by insurance, and you're now being told that you're as dangerous as the Ebola virus, HIV, or global warming. And the Los Angeles Times, the New York Post, the New York Daily News, the New York Times, they all walk in lockstep with this notion. They are so wrong on so many levels. I'm Gary Nall, and I want to thank all the people who attended my 5.5-hour webinar on vaccines yesterday. If you want to get a copy, just go up and you'll see how you can download it on PRN.fm. Thank you for listening, and have a nice day.